You ever talk to an optimist? They're optimistic about just about everything. Why? And what are they looking for? What kind of answers are they seeking? Up next, we'll talk with Mark Stevenson, an optimist tour of the future on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, right now we're going to go live to the United Kingdom. Writer Mark Stevenson, director of a cultural learning agency as well as a science communication agency. He puts the trends of tomorrow's world into perspective with a series of tools of curiosity, open-mindedness, and reason while helping to take stock of the reasons for hope. He is the fellow of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufacturers, and Commerce. He's also a comedian, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Mark, how are you?
I'm very well. It's great to be on your show. Good. Thank you for having me.
I guess you would have to be a comedian to be optimistic, wouldn't you?
Oh, well, no, I don't think so. Why'd you say that?
Well, I just think comedians have a different outlook in life. They're always happy.
Oh, I thought you're kidding me, aren't you?
No.
Come on.
Aren't
come on.
You?
Yeah, well, I'm happy, but a lot of comedians, you know, they're almost exclusively haunted by demons and ghosts and depression. That's what makes a lot of them so funny.
Really? So, I didn't know that.
I mean, it's less the case these days, but if you go back to the 60s, certainly you'll find that many of the great comics were, you know, either committed suicide or ended up depressed or penniless. So I don't think being a comedian, you have to be optimistic, other than that you have to go on stage, of course.
Right.
Which is an act of optimism or masochism, depending.
That's true. Depending on who's in the audience, right?
Yeah, but I think a lot of comedians actually are very kind of cynical in their outlook, and that's what makes them sometimes very funny. I think the key skill in a comedian is really being able to sort of nail an observation very quickly, to be succinct in getting across a particular point and making it easy for people to grasp and maybe laugh at themselves. I suppose that's the same as being a good author as well. So I guess it's kind of, I brought that skill to writing the book, I guess.
Mark, let me ask you, while I've got you, how are they reacting to Piers Morgan in Britain and his role here on CNN, replacing Larry King? What do they say about him?
Well, to be honest, I've been very busy promoting my book, so I haven't heard a huge amount. But the one thing I can tell you is that we have these adverts on the tube, which are now kind of projected, so they're kind of live, they're kind of video adverts. And you've got Piers here sort of grinning with this kind of smug look on his face. He's looking fantastically happy with himself. I can just about everybody on the tube station is going, can we turn that off? This is really offensive. You know, we're not used to it over here. We as you know, being English, we're not that fond of smugness or self-aggrandizing.
Right,
so,
right.
So I think... I think we're generally kind of like, oh, thank God he's gone to America. Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say. But, I don't think we're that bothered, to be honest.
Did they like him on Britain's Got Talent?
Well, some people do, some people don't. You know, I mean, it's a show that divides people. Some people think it's this great way to discover new talent. Other people think it's this ridiculous kind of almost gladiatorial, unfair kind of piece of entertainment that takes the contestants and just uses them as fodder rather than real talent. So, you know, it depends whether you think it's for the contestants or the audience or the hosts. You know, at the end of the day, Simon Cowell's making an awful lot of money out of other people.
A lot of money, absolutely.
Yeah. And more.
Hey, you're going to be in the States pretty soon, I hear.
I am. I'm coming to the States on Sunday. Yeah, I'm there for about 3 weeks, I think.
Good for you. Book on a book tour?
Book tour, yeah. I can't remember. It's like four or five cities in a ridiculous number of days.
I think you're in D.C., New York, San Francisco, Seattle. All great cities, by the way.
I'm looking forward. I've never been to Seattle before, so I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm talking at places like Google and the U.S. Treasury and Microsoft, so that's going to be pretty exciting.
So, well, tell me a little bit more about yourself, Mark. In this, we'll get into your book in a second here, but tell me about you.
Well, what would you like to know?
Well, I mean, director of cultural learning agency. What is that? What is that? What do you do?
Okay, well, my whole life is dedicated to two things, basically. About 3 or 4 years ago, and that's things, probably more now, 4 years ago, I woke up and realized I hated my job. I just had one of those mornings where you wake up and go,
You're not alone. A lot of people feel that.
What am I doing with my life? And I was actually building a company, and I realized that I was kind of making my own prison, because I was going to have stockholders, and I was going to have, you know, staff. And I was actually doing something I didn't really massively care about. I mean, it was a fair enough job. It was in marketing and in high-tech industry. I thought, you know, that's fine. And then I woke up and thought, you know, I don't really want to do this for
suit and tie, briefcase type guy?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, not so much. But, you know, I was thinking, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. So I sat down and I thought to myself, what do what do I really care about? I've got the rest of my life to go on here. What do I really, really care about? And I realized I cared about two things. And one was, I suppose, what I call critical thinking or empiricism, or the ability for people to handle information and make sensible judgments based on it, because we're not really taught that in our school system. If you look at a lot of our politics and all of our press, you know, it's a lot of opinion, and people find it very difficult to sort of sift the wheat from the chaff, to be able to make decisions based on evidence rather than emotion. And that really concerned me, because I saw a lot of, you know, I guess bad politics and bad press. And I thought, you know, I'm going to try and do my best to help people to learn the skills so that they can make better decisions and optimum decisions in their lives. And the other thing I realized I cared about was optimism, which is what I mean is by there's a kind of a collective fatalism we've got now about the future. When we think about the future, we think about it as a damage limitation exercise at best. And it could actually be a renaissance. And I wanted to say, you know, I'm not saying the future is going to be better. It could be terrible. It could be very much like Kylie Minogue, you know, kind of exciting but short.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of figured that the thing is, if you can't imagine a better future, if you can't even see it, then there's no way it's ever going to happen. If you can't even, you know, it's like your personal life. If you can't imagine yourself getting that job, you're very likely to do badly in the interview, if you know what I mean. So I realized I cared about these two things. You know, let's be optimistic in what we aim for, but let's kind of be very sensible about how we go there. And there's a great quote from, it's been attributed to various philosophers and thinkers, but it's about optimism of the will and pessimism of the intellect. So I realized I kind of cared about those two things. Aim for the good stuff, but be really careful about how you get there and look at every obstacle. And then the third thing I realized was that sitting around, you know, in my flat and with friends of mine who quite often agree with you was not going to be good enough. I had to go out and start, you know, promoting this idea to as many people as possible if I really cared about it. So that's why I started doing stand-up comedy. That a cultural learning agency is where we work with governments or cultural institutions. So we recently did some work with the Smithsonian, for instance, about helping them think about how they communicate certain subjects in a way that is engaging.
I
also run a science communication agency where we will make sure that if you want to talk about science, then you get the right people in the room. And that's not to say they will have to be scientists, but for instance, quite often they'll get a host in who's maybe a TV presenter who knows nothing about the subject. So it doesn't, you know, make the debate work very well. And the other thing was writing the book. And, yeah, so that's me. I'm kind of dedicating my life to optimism of the will and pessimism of the intellect.
Okay.
Is that enough? Did I go on long enough?
No, you know I've got you for 3 hours. Did they tell you that?
Okay. Yeah, I knew that.
All right. When you hear the word optimist, you think it's somebody who's upbeat. And what does that mean to you, being an optimist?
I think that's a really good question, because I have a bit of a problem with the word optimist, because it's come to mean something. It's come to mean wishful thinking, I think. If you think an optimist is somebody who thinks everything's going to be all right, whatever, and they'll kind of maybe sometimes ignore the really obvious warning signs. So I think optimism is a bit like the word feminism. It doesn't mean what it means anymore. You know, to anybody under 25, certainly over here, feminist means lesbian, dungaree-wearing man-hater, whereas actually, you know, it used to mean just somebody who believes in equality of opportunity for men and women.
Right.
And optimism now, I think, means to a lot of people wishful thinking, idiot, who always thinks the glass is half full, even if somebody's smashing the glass over his head.
Partly sunny when it's raining out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I couldn't find a better word that was snappier for the title. So, I mean, what it means to me is kind of I call it pragmatic optimism. You know, so it is about that thing I talked earlier about. You have to be optimistic in what you aim for, otherwise you'll never get there. I mean, God, you know, the American dream is that very example, isn't it? You know, that is what I'm talking about, pragmatic optimism. You aim for the right thing, but you believe there's lots of hard work there. You've got to use your smarts. You've got to, you know, put your back behind it, and that's the pragmatism. So, yeah, I guess it's the same thing as the American dream for me, that kind of attitude.
You went out and got a lot of people who are in the know. Was it difficult to get to them? I mean, how did you do that, would you say?
Yeah, a lot of people have said this, you know, and a lot of other writers have come to me and said, gee, how did you get that guy? He
never
He never talks to anybody. And I don't know. I
guess you were optimistic about it.
Well, first I was optimistic. The first thing is, I think a lot of people, when they're trying to get interviews, they phone up people and they kind of make this assumption that these people want to have coverage, that they want to be in a book or they want to be on TV or they, you know. And I didn't do that because if you phone up a very, very busy guy, like a guy called George Church I saw, who's head of genetics at Harvard. He phoned up and said, would you like to be in my book? He's going, you know what? I'm a bit busy, you know, on my way to winning a Nobel Prize. So, you know, I haven't got time to talk to you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I did find out is I did the sort of thing that you just asked me to do, which is I didn't say, do you want to be in my book? I said, look, I care about, you know, learning. I care about people being literate in the ways of critical thinking. And I care about optimism of what we aim for. And therefore, I'm writing a book. And I think they bought the philosophy first and therefore saw the reason for being in the book. I also think if you phone up and say I'm a comedian, that there is this kind there is a kind of respect for comedians that other people don't get, because a lot of people are very terrified of the idea of going on stage and doing that. So you've almost got a bit of a hierarchy there. You can almost, they kind of go, oh, wow. But they kind of respect you a bit. Whereas if you're just perhaps a normal hack or a normal journalist, they might go, oh, it's another journalist. If you're a comedian who's saying, I believe in critical thinking, they'll go, okay, this guy is interesting. And then they'll engage you for another 30 seconds. And then you've got 30
if
seconds.
If you can capture them. Yeah.
Yeah. So George Church said to me, for instance, he's like, you know, probably the architect of the biotech revolution. He's, you know, got to one point, he said, okay, well, maybe I'll do an interview with you, but tell me a joke first. And if I think it's funny, then I...
then we'll move on. If not, yeah, go out. Get out of my office, right?
Yeah, indeed. And I went to see another lady called Cynthia Brazil, who's probably the world-leading expert in something called sociable robotics in MIT in Boston. And they've got a policy now that she does one face-to-face interview a year. You know,
that's it? No wonder I can't get her on this show. You got her.
Yeah, do you know how I did it? I'll tell you how I did it. I mean, it's in the book. But, you know, I was on, this is by my eighth phone call with her PA, who was this extraordinarily brilliant woman called Polly Guggenheim, who is basically a New York policewoman detective turned PA to a roboticist. You know, you're not getting through there. And after eight conversations with her, I was thinking, well, they haven't said no yet. I said, come on, seriously, what does it take to get this interview? She went, you really want to know? I said, yeah, I really want to know. She went, high-quality Belgian chocolates.
Thank God that's what she said.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You were sweating, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, do I really? Yeah, you'll have to wear, you know, lederhosen and come and sing in German to it.
That's right. That. And make me laugh.
Yeah, absolutely. So I turned up, you know, with these inordinately expensive chocolates at MIT, and I got my interview.
Mark, do you find these people who are tremendously brilliant at what they do, do you find them to be practical, real people when you meet them?
I think in general, yes. Because, I mean, I met a lot of scientists and philosophers and politicians and a whole bunch of people. And I think to get to any level of success, you have to be pretty practical. You have to really sit down and think, how am I going to get to where I'm going to go? And sometimes you have to fight against a prevailing wisdom. So, yeah, they were very practical. I mean, obviously, some of them were a little bit, you and me might think they're a little bit crazy because they're kind of single-minded.
Well, they're eccentric, aren't they?
Some of them are pretty eccentric with their ideas, certainly. I mean, I went to see some guys who talk about this idea of transhumanism, the idea that we can live for thousands and thousands of years through, you know, merging our bodies with new technologies or advancing our medicine and so on and so forth. You know, and these are very smart guys, but, you know, your instant reaction to them is, whoa, you're a little bit crazy. So, but in general, I've had to say they were all very generous. There was one guy who I'm not going to say who it was, who was a little bit bipolar with me, in that I sent all the stuff I wrote back to the experts to check it, to say, you know, did I represent you correctly? Did I get it right?
Sure.
That wasn't to say I gave him an easy time, but it was to make sure that I hadn't misrepresented them.
Right, you wanted to be as accurate as you could.
Yeah, and also I sent them all back the criticisms or the counter-arguments and say, you know, do you think this is fair? And I was very diligent about that.
And by the way, not a lot of writers or authors would give the interviewee that option. So you're nice about that.
Yeah, and I think that's another reason I was able to get to so many people, because after I'd done a couple, they would say, okay, look, I'm going to recommend you to X and X and X. And the thing is, you know, they don't mind if there's a counter point of view put forward, even if they completely disagree with it. They just want to check that their point of view is being put forward in an accurate manner that they feel happy with. And also, these people like debate. They like to be challenged. I mean, a lot of the process, of course, of science is being proved wrong all the time. So they're okay with it. And I think this is something that's a lot easier when you're writing a book because you've got, you know, a year to write it. It's not so easy, I guess, if you're a journalist on a newspaper and you've got to file your copy, you know, in the
next
hour.
Yeah, you've got your editor screaming at you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and then your sub-editor takes it and changes it completely. And by the time it's published, the guy on the other end of the phone wants to kill you. So I was lucky in that respect. Yeah, certainly.
So the bipolar guy, what happened?
So he was having an extreme genius, and I'm not going to mention his name out of courtesy, but I would send him my stuff, and I sent it to him one day, and he said, "This is the worst piece of journalistic trash, you know, I've ever seen in my life," and listed this whole, you know, range of things that were wrong with it, having only read the first page.
No way!
Yeah. So I emailed him back and said, "Well, thank you for your criticism. I wonder if you read the rest of it, because all the points you raise, I think I address." And the next day, I got an email back from him saying, "I'm so sorry."
Really?
Yeah. And I'm really, no. I mean, this is some of the best writing I've seen on my system.
He actually thought that was it.
No, he just got so upset with the first page because he's so sensitive. And this guy doesn't give interviews, so he's, because I think, and he has had a rough ride. I'm not going to say who it was, but. You know, he was so sensitive that he instantly saw everything as an attack. And then when I got him to look at it in more detail, I said, "This is brilliant." And then he said, "I've got a few points." And I addressed those few points. The next email was like, "You're an idiot. You don't." And we went through this kind of, one email was he loved it. Next email he hated it. Next email, and this went on for about 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's bipolar.
At the end of it, he was happy. And I think he was wanting to make sure that I was engaged and listening, I think, more than anything else. So that was the trickiest bit. But in general, no, they were all great. All great, I have to say. I mean, and you know.
How'd you pick the subjects and subject matter for your book?
Well, I kind of followed my nose. I mean, I started off that I wanted to write a book because, when it comes to talking about the future and advances in science and technology and the way we think and what's happening with the internet, a lot of us don't really feel that in the loop. You know, you hear about the biotech revolution, but, you know, what is that exactly? Well, nanotechnology, what's going on with that? Is the climate changing? If it is changing, can we do anything about it? What is really going on with the internet? How does this all play together? And I think a lot of us have a kind of a dim view of it. You know, it's out there. We've heard these words, but don't really know what's going on with medicine. I've certainly found that in the press and in the discourse in politics, I wasn't getting a picture that I felt enabled me to make decisions about my future. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go and ask. And also, a lot of the books you read about this stuff, they're written by people and for people who read New Scientist or Scientific American. You know, they're written for an audience that's kind of, I guess, already science literate to a certain degree. And I wanted to write a book for my mum, really, and myself. So I was influenced as much by writers like Bill Bryson as I was by big science writers. And I just wanted to go on this journey to try and discover it for myself. And so I chose the subjects pretty much by following my nose. The first thing I wanted to do was look at these guys who are the transhumanists, who believe that we can live forever through technology and through medicine. And I did that because I just wanted to throw myself in the deep end. And then I just started unraveling it. So I thought, after seeing them, okay, I'll go to the top guy in genetics. What is the genetics revolution about? Okay, well, after I've seen him, let's go and talk about this idea of synthetic biology. Can we engineer cells? Can we change the way that life works? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And then, you know, you're in MIT. Okay, I'll go and see the top person in robotics. Okay, well, now we're talking about robot brains. I'll go and see the top person, in artificial intelligence. Okay, well, while I'm doing that, you know, I'll go and talk about what's happening with the internet. So I went off to see Vince Cerf.
That's exciting. We're going to take this commercial, Mark, that pays the bills, and we'll come right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. We're going to get into some incredible things in a moment with Mark Stevenson, author of An Optimist's Tour of the Future. One curious man sets out to answer what's next. So get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Mark Stevenson as we talk about being an optimist, his tour of the future. In this tour, Mark, what do you think about the future? I mean, is there a thumbs up for us here, or are we in trouble?
That's a really great question. And actually, I don't specifically answer that question, and deliberately so. What I'm saying is that we've got everything to play for. So the future could be terrible. I mean, I looked at lots of very interesting and powerful technologies, and I'm convinced there will be a nanotech 9/11. There will be a biotech Three Mile Island. There will be accidents with a lot of these tools.
Yeah.
What we tend to do, though, is we often throw out the baby with the bathwater. So there are also lots of incredible benefits and also countermeasures to the problems we may have with these tools. So it all, for me, it's all about the narrative of the future we tell ourselves. If we say to ourselves, look, we can take these tools and we can use them wisely, then we're more likely to. I mean, one thing that I went to speak to at the end of the book, I got almost lost in the future. I went to see so many massive advances. I was kind of like, you know, it's like my brain was like a pocket watch that had been overwhelmed. It was about to explode. I'd seen so much stuff. And I wanted to try and make sense of it and say, how does a normal person get a handle on all this? So I went to speak to some philosophers and some deep thinkers and business leaders and all sorts of people. And one of the guys I spoke to was a philosopher and an ethicist and also a biologist called Marc Badeau. And he said, I think perhaps the most sensible thing that anybody said to me, he said, look, change will happen. You can either try to stop it from happening, you can try to ignore it, or you can try to influence it in a positive way. Trying to stop it from happening is futile.
Yeah, you can't stop it.
Yeah, and ignoring it is irresponsible. So for me, that leaves you one option left, which is we're all in this game. We've all got skin in the game. Let's try and influence these changes in a positive direction. If you say, I mean, it's just impossible now, I believe, to stop the advance of knowledge, particularly with the spread of the internet. I mean, you can do it if you're incredibly draconian for a short amount of time. You know, you can do a North Korea if you really want to. But the cost of that is so much higher than trying to engage in change in a positive way. So it's about the narrative of the story, the future we tell ourselves. Are we going to aim for something good whilst accepting bad things are going to happen along the way? Or are we going to be completely precautionary and just try and do nothing and stop everything from happening because we're scared of some of the bad things that might happen? And if we do that, they're going to happen anyway, and we're going to miss out on the good stuff. So that's kind of, you know, I'm not saying the future will be brilliant. I'm saying it could be terrible, but I'm saying it could be fantastic, and everybody of good conscience has to be in that game.
You know, if we have, Mark, some of these mishaps that are going to occur, let's say they decide we're going to clone someone and, you know, comes out with four heads, for crying out loud. are they going to back off because this happened?
Well, I think what's important here, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is you have to be informed about what the science is, what the technology is, and what's possible with it. And then you have to make a balance on that. So if they're cloning someone with four heads, then they've got the cloning clearly very wrong, because it probably didn't start out with four heads. and also, again, you have to realize that the idea of human cloning is a very long way down the line, and we need to build up an ethical framework around that. So one of the things that I became very concerned about, and I found myself talking about more and more, is based around exactly this question, which is how do you legislate for new and powerful technology? And one of the things that became very clear to me is that governments aren't doing it quick enough and they're not doing it well enough. And that's because I believe that the rate of change and rate of innovation you'll see in science and technology is getting ever faster and faster and faster. As we build one tool, it'll give us a platform to innovate and create the next tool. We're used to seeing this in computing. We're now seeing it in nanotechnology. We're now seeing particularly in medicine. And we're also seeing those three disciplines kind of collide into one another with the genomics revolution and genome sequencing, the plummeting cost of that. So you're seeing this massive rate of innovation, and the rate that happens is very different to the rate at which government legislates. So you've got this complete mismatch between innovation and legislation. And the reason I think that is because you hear a lot of governments talk about, and big institutions talk about innovation, mm-hmm. how they want to stimulate it, and yet they don't innovate themselves in the way they operate. So the example I use it when I'm doing talks over here is the last innovation we had in parliamentary democracy in the UK was in 1928, when they decided it would be okay to give women the vote. Other than that, it hasn't really changed shape since the 1700s. So it means that it's completely out of step with the rate of innovation. Which means that by the time they legislate, they're legislating too late, they're legislating without knowledge, and the legislation is out of date, you know, within 6 months. So we need to find a way collectively to build systems that have the same time constant, the same rate of innovation in our legislature that is happening in the real world. You know, so that, I think, is a very big problem. Institutional innovation is the one thing that isn't happening in many places where it should, and government, I think, is the classic example of that.
When you were doing your research, what did you come across that you found to be very fascinating?
That's kind of an unfair question, because all of it...
You liked it all, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, all of it was fascinating. I didn't say I liked it all, because some of it does make you go, oh, hang on, that's a bit scary. You know, yeah. there's some serious ethical implications there. There's some stuff I've got to think about. And if not for me, certainly for my kids or my grandkids, because they're going to be growing up in this world. So I wouldn't say I liked it all, but I certainly found all of it fascinating. One of the things I think I found most so surprising, perhaps, as a way, is that some innovations were not technological. Some of them were kind of like, okay, these guys just thought about this a bit differently. So I went to see a new, well, actually a very old method of farming that had been resurrected in the Australian outback, where you're used to seeing, you know, if you think of the typical vision of the Australian outback, it's this kind of terracotta.
Bleak.
Bleak, you know, with, and they have this, as we know at the moment, this terrible cycle of drought and flood. The ground gets very compacted. When the rain does eventually come, it can't sink into the ground. It runs off the top. You've got this kind of disaster.
Yeah.
I went to see some guys who had changed the way they farmed. And I was looking at farms that looked more like rural England than they did from what I'm seeing.
Nice and rolling, huh?
Yeah, and you could see the difference down the line of a fence between the one farm that was using this method and one farm that wasn't. And all they had done was change the way they fenced their cattle and got the cattle to move differently, which had a relationship with the land. The land grew. And you know,
that's fascinating.
The cattle
broke up the grounds, right?
Well, no, it was about the grass. There's a symbiotic relationship between grass and grazing animals. And you see this in somewhere like the Serengeti. So if you go back to a natural grassland, like in the past, it was sort of, you know, wildebeest or bison, you know, in the American grasslands or the African grasslands. And these huge herds, you still see this in the Serengeti, and they go on this kind of massive pilgrimage. It takes them like a year, and they go 1,800 miles, always looking for fresh grass, always looking for fresh water. And there's a relationship because a grass plant has its growing buds at the base of the plant, which means it needs an animal to come along and eat the top of it off. Otherwise, it will die in its own shade. But what happens in the wild is it eats the grass, and then it wanders off. This huge herd wanders off, and it won't be back for probably like a year or 180 days. So the grass grows a little more. Now, what happens in normal grassland farming is we take a big herd, we split up into smaller herds, put them all in big paddocks. There's no predators, so they can roam where they like, and they eat the grass. And as soon as it grows again, they eat it again, So the grass never gets a chance to grow. And that reduces the carbon content in the soil. It reduces the richness of the soil, and soon the soils become very barren. So what you should do instead is take all your cattle on one farm, stick them in one big herd, make a load of much smaller paddocks, and then just shift them through once every couple of days. And you're mimicking this pilgrimage. That means the grass gets a chance to grow. It gets eaten properly, so there's more feed. So a lot of these farms don't have to buy feed anymore. Then if you're worried about climate change, the good thing about this is that every time they eat the grass, the root matter breaks off underneath because the plant is in balance. The same amount of root matter will come off the base of the plant as on the top of the plant. And this leaves some carbon in the soil. And this sequesters actually, you know, tons and tons and tons, millions of tons of carbon into the soil. If you increased the soil carbon content of all the world's grasslands by just 1%, you could offset 12 years of global CO2 emissions.
That would be huge. Yeah.
Absolutely huge. Now, the thing is, even if you don't accept the global warming argument, this is incredibly good news for your farm because soils that are rich in carbon increase the ability for that soil to retain water. So a 1% increase in carbon means that in a hectare, you'll get an extra 150 tons of water storage. So if you're in a nation that has drought, that's a big deal per hectare. Also, I went to see these guys because they're having this new method. They didn't have to buy loads of fertilizer. They weren't buying loads of feed. I saw one guy who I said to him, what's your cost of production? And it was a quarter of the average price of his neighbors. So he's able to sell his beef at a huge profit, cheaper than his neighbors could make it. So it makes massive, you know, economic sense anyway. And the other thing is that the value of your land is increasing slowly over time. So a lot of the institutional investors are looking at this are pension funds because they want assets that grow very slowly over a small amount of time. So, and for me, that was completely fascinating because there was no nanotechnology involved. There was no biotech. You know, there was no computing. There was no, you know, sort of boffins in white coats. It was some guys with, you know, some fencing.
Simple.
and a couple of motorbikes, you know, going and completely turning around their businesses. You know, in Australia, a lot of farms are now surviving on drought assistance. They're suffering terribly. You know, their lifestyles are awful. I was visiting these farms, you know, as I say, that looked green and verdant in the middle of the outback, seeing these healthy, happy families. The houses had all mod cons. you know, this was very different to what I'd been used to seeing. And to me, that said that, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of thinking more carefully. You don't always have to rely on technology. You can sometimes go, how do I just sit back and look at what's happening here and try and think a bit more clearly? And I think that's probably the most important thing any of us can do, you know. But you need to be aware of what's happening with technology, but realize that the solution isn't always a technological one.
Well, and
so I suppose that fascinated me the most.
Speaking of technology, I am fascinated, Mark, by what has happened with these smartphones, Facebook. I mean, we just saw what happened in Egypt, kicked off by their communication on Facebook, Twitter, all this. I mean, it's, to me, that's remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, I mean, we are becoming more connected. There's no doubt about that. I went to see a man called Vint Cerf, who is now the vice president of Google, or one of the vice presidents of Google. But he's also one of the guys who co-invented the internet. You know, he's called the father of the internet. He's actually one of the fathers.
You mean Al Gore wasn't with him?
No, Al wasn't there. This was just Vint. We talked about this increasing interconnection and how you start to see people connecting on a level they haven't been able to before and have conversations before. Now, that has good aspects and bad aspects. So you will find echo chambers of hate on the internet. If you're a wacko, you can much more easily find other wackos, and you can tune into that echo chamber and you can hear the voices you want to hear much more easily. Because it used to be you might have just been the one guy, you know, who liked to dress yourself up as a banana and recite poetry in your neighborhood, you know, and that was it. Now you can find another 10 of them around the world, and you've got a banana poetry society. More sinisterly, you can have a terrorist organizations using this. And because the web is so anonymous and hard to trace, then it's actually ideal for evildoers to get together and do stuff. And I think one of the guys I said we're going to see a lot more homegrown terrorism on American soil because of this. I think that's a very real threat. But on balance, you'll see that most people use the internet not for evil doing, but for getting together, for community, for finding...
It is a social network.
If you look at the most popular sites on the internet, they are tools, they are sites that either allow us to learn or to communicate with one another. And you see these fantastic innovations. My favorite example is something, I don't know if you know them, the Legion of Extraordinary Dancers. And they are basically a bunch of kids who were doing dance moves on street corners all around the world, filming it and putting it up on YouTube. And so a kid would like do a dance move on, you know, in Tokyo.
Sure.
And a guy in Detroit would see it and go, hey, I can innovate on that. I could. Within a couple of hours, he'd send that move back. And then all of a sudden, you had this massive laboratory of dancing. And there were, you know, people going, hey, look at this guy. I never thought he could do that move. That's amazing. And then a guy called John Chu came along. He looked at the biggest hits on YouTube for these dances, went and found them all from around the world, you know, Detroit, London, Hong Kong, wherever they were. Brought them together, created this dance troupe, which is a phenomenon because these kids are so good. They danced at the Oscars in 2009. They've got a movie coming out. You know,
is that something?
And I think, you know, this is technology allowing people to innovate in perhaps what you would think of as the least technological thing that people communicate on, dance, how to move their bodies. And you're seeing that everywhere. You know, scientists communicating more, political movements communicating more with each other. So, but generally, we find that our fates are more joined, and we see that. It's much easier now to see what's happening in Egypt because of, you know, our ability to communicate and talk to people there and find out what's going on. And on balance, that is a good thing. However, you have to be very careful that it does come with some downsides. And I make these points in the book very clearly. You know, this is the downside. This is the upside. Let's try and move it in the direction of the upside, but be aware of the downside. So, yeah, the interconnectedness thing is a step change in human consciousness and in us all seeing ourselves as part of the same planet.
Well, and one of the downsides of all of this, I think, Mark, is let's say technologically something happens, an X flare from the sun, or there's a massive power outage for some reason. I think people will go crazy if they can't use their cell phones, send a text message to someone, use the internet. I absolutely think they'll go bonkers, don't you?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we are entangled with our technology, and we always have been. From the moment we invented fire, you know, or the wheel, if you go back to, you know, caveman times and you take away fire, you know, 20 years after they've had it, they're going to fall over. They're going, we can't do what we do.
We can't live anymore.
Yeah, we can't do without the wheel. You know, so we have this symbiotic relationship with technology, and the way that human beings evolve now is not through biology, but through technology and culture. And we have to begin to understand that relationship and begin to direct it in positive ways. So yes, it's absolutely true. We are completely dependent on our technology, but that's not a new thing. We've been dependent on our technology since the first person picked up a jawbone and realized they could use it as a club. And we're not going back. So the question is, again, back to this point, how do you influence that in a positive way? How do you make sure that we're protected from... I mean, the good thing about the internet, for instance, is it was designed to survive a nuclear blast. That was the whole point of it. It was built out of DARPA and the ARPANET. So how do we make our technologies robust? Now, I mean, we worry about what happens if the internet goes down or what happens if the telephone system goes down. Yeah, but what happens if the sewers went down? You know, that's a technology too. So I think it's very important for us to realize we are now technological beings and we have to make peace with that and realize that's part of who we are.
One of my producers, just bought a microwave oven, and he was all excited because he went out and bought a frozen dinner and said, I don't even have to push buttons. All I have to do is put the code, the barcode, the number into the microwave oven. You push it, and then the oven knows what to do all by itself.
God, that to me, that's a step too far. Do you think that's a step too far?
It's crazy. It's unbelievable.
You know, that's kind of like that's taking me completely out of the loop. You know, the food is talking to the oven.
I mean, soon you'll be able to verbally say, pot pie, put it in there and it cooks it.
Well, I talked to one guy who's working on something he calls the nanofactory. This is a very long way off, but it's an interesting speculation, which is the idea that we'll be able to manufacture anything from the molecular level up or the atomic level up. So this is basically your Star Trek sci-fi replicator machine. And there's some research going into how would we go about doing that. So your idea that you're about to say, you know, cup of Earl Grey hot, as Jean-Luc Picard did. You know, there are people working on that now. And that again, has massive implications because you get to a world without scarcity. What happens to your economy? What happens to your politics? You know, what do you do with your time? Do you need to go to work? If you can start to manufacture things very, very cheaply. And you are seeing a trend, certainly in other areas, where things are getting much, much cheaper at higher and higher capacity. And that has very interesting implications socially and economically. So yeah, but the microwave thing, I'm still going to cook my own food. I like to get a frying pan out. And also, I think this, when I talked about the relationship with technology, mm-hmm. we have to realize that you are in charge of it. Now, nobody is forcing you to use the internet, just as nobody forces you to eat cheese.
But it does make life easier. It makes life easier. Yeah. Technology makes life simple.
This is why people embrace it so much. You know, people say, "Oh, I don't really want it. I don't." But you'll notice that people who argue against technology. And advances in technology, they use technology to do it. They just use slightly older technology.
Well, you know, in the old days of working as a talk show host,
yeah.
You know, I would have to look for volumes of information, let's say, on you. I'd have to look it up in newspapers, yeah. Whatever anybody would be able to send me, in addition to your book. Now you sit back at the internet, spend some time researching, and it's done in a nice, compact package, and you're ready to go.
Yeah,
and I mean it's made life easier.
Yeah, the other thing is it's made life easier in some ways. I think this a bit. I mean, certainly I couldn't have written this book without access to the internet because I was out of scientific journals.
Could you imagine doing this longhand, for example?
Oh, I mean, amazing. Well, it wouldn't have happened. You know, it just wouldn't have happened.
Well, we're coming up to the top of the hour mark. We're going to come right back with you in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. I want to. Get into some of the things that you've seen with the robots. And tell me about this underwater cabinet meeting. Where in the heck that happened? We'll be back.